very few things that you can go to where you see something that's amazing. And it was. It was amazing. And as he was running around the bases, I was thinking to myself, who can do that? I mean, where else, literally where else can you go to have such pure joy over something?
You're listening to St. Pete X. Today's episode is brought to you by Cityverse. Cityverse brings the community together on a new civic platform powered by Catalyst News. St. Pete Cityverse is launching soon. You can learn more and reserve your home space at cityverse.life. Now, enjoy the conversation.
Joining me today on SPX is many-time best-selling author, famed interviewer, St. Pete resident, Peter Gollenbach. Welcome, sir.
Thank you so much, Joe.
So I want to start with a state of the nation for baseball. You've been following it a long time. The game has changed. Other sports have come up and become competitors. You know, the landscape for baseball has changed. Video games are here, et cetera, et cetera. So what is the state of the nation for baseball in the current world we live in?
Well, several years ago, baseball was in trouble because for one reason or another, the pitchers would take 2 or 3 minutes between pitches and the games would go 4 hours. Now, I've been a season ticket holder for the Tampa Bay Rays for 20-something years, and even I would sit there in my seat, screaming at the pitcher, either our pitcher or their pitcher, will you throw the ball? And they did something about it. They did something smart. Mm-hmm. They passed a rule that the pitchers now have to pitch within, I think it's 18 seconds if there's nobody on base and 20 seconds if there's somebody on base. But it's sort of saved the game.
Yeah.
People are now flocking to come see these ball games here in St. Petersburg because they're not sitting there pulling their hair out as the pitchers take, you know, 2-3 minutes between pitches.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't tell you how huge it is.
It's amazing. Something seemingly innocuous, you know, not tied to the fabric of the game,
yeah,
but tied to life experience of being at the game can make such a difference.
And one other thing that baseball did, which was interesting, which was totally Joe Madden's fault. You know, Madden was our wonderful manager. And he, using, you know, AI or whatever, figured out exactly where the opposing batters would hit.
Mm.
So he started putting three fielders on one side of the infield because he knew that the pull hitters would never hit the ball to right field. The right-handed pull hitters would never hit the ball to right field. So he started putting three players over there, and sure enough, everybody's batting average went down.
Hmm.
So one of the other things that Major League Baseball did, and quite rightly, I do believe, is make a rule that only two fielders can be on either side of second base.
Hmm.
So now you do have your second baseman playing close to being on the other side,
mm-hmm,
but not on the other side. And that's made a difference, too.
So we had a couple years of crazy shifts, and then
oh,
they went away.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
My goodness, my goodness.
And that was Madden.
He started it, but yeah, then everybody else started to do it.
Yeah.
So you got the combination there for the couple years of a lot of ground outs and 4-hour games.
Yeah. Well, I don't like ground outs, but I did like the strategy of the shift because if you grew up watching it, seeing that giant hole over between second and third was just, you've got to be able to get it there, and then they just didn't.
No, I know. Yeah. Well, I mean, for a long while, too, nobody would bunt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally, nobody would bunt. And on Madden, too, nobody stole very much either. It was a 3-run home run game.
Mm-hmm.
Under Kevin Cash, I mean, Cash has got a lot of critiques, but I got to tell you, the guy's done a magnificent job.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Rays may well you can look it up, may well lead the league in stolen bases right now.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. They've been punching above their weight for years.
Oh, they've just been playing great ball. 2 weeks ago, you would have thought that the Rays were going to be the worst team in our division. They lost three straight to the woeful Chicago White Sox, then two out of three to the Milwaukee Brewers. And the Rays then brought up two new players, Johnny DeLuca, who's a center fielder. Mm-hmm. They sat down Siri, who was hitting about 150 and not hustling. And they brought in this catcher, Rutfeldt. You can't pronounce his name, but boy, can he hit and boy, can he catch. And it's amazing. You put in two guys, and right now the Rays are looking to be as good a team as the Yankees or the Orioles. And it'll be interesting to see how well they do this year.
Were you at the game when they had the catcher in there throwing the knuckleball a couple weeks ago? They were down 10-1 in the eighth, and they I think it was Rutfeldt. They put the catcher into pitch, and it was hilarious. It's like it was funny.
Yeah.
He was throwing knuckleballs. A couple of them ended up being batting practice. I think only one home run, but he made it through two innings.
No, he did. Yeah, I always get a chuckle when they make that.
It invigorated the crowd, though.
Fielder's pitch. Yeah, but that was one of those games where you thought to yourself, boy, this team is really terrible.
Yeah.
And it's not.
So state of the nation then, with these changes, you feel like baseball is holding steady.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, still is got a big special place in the heart of America.
Yeah, well, baseball, and I guess pro football the same way, is a religion.
Mm.
You know, you grow up with it, and it's in your blood. It's part of you. And it's a very kind religion, too. You can be a Republican, a Democrat, an independent. You can be Christian, Jewish, or what have you. And if this fella is rooting for your team, he's your friend.
Yeah.
And you root together. I love the game. I love the fact that we're playing Major League Baseball in St. Petersburg. It's so incredibly special.
Yeah.
And I think most people realize that too.
Yeah. And you know, you talk about baseball as religion. The Florida teams have struggled the most historically with attendance. Is this because in part the young followers, the you know, that haven't gotten their faith yet in that individual team, and we're still too much a place of transplants? Or why do you think the Florida teams have
struggled? Well, you got a lot of transplants. I mean, it was amazing during the 3-game series against the Mets. I mean, the place was filled with fans wearing Mets uniforms. I mean, they're just crazy Mets fans.
Yeah.
They are. And the Yankee fans are the same way, and the Yankees train in Tampa, and that never should have been allowed. And so, you know, the Yankee fans will only go to Yankee games.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter. I mean, the fandom is picking up this year.
Yeah.
I mean, they're seeing that this is a team with a lot of potential. The 3 games against the Mets, we had, you know, 23,000 people every single game. It was fabulous.
Yeah. And I mean, the team's what, 26 some years old now. So, you know, kids coming at 7, 8 now are getting in their 20s, starting to come to the games themselves.
They are.
And so we are seeing our first generation of born and raised Rays fans.
And you're seeing, you know, 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds still coming to the games with their parents, which I love.
How did you experience the Moneyball years, as far as, you know, you talk about changing the game when some of the luster came off of the big stars and paying for the names and the home runs and going to the more stats driven lineups and things that were a little more mechanical? Do you think that had any major ripple?
Well, other than getting the Red Sox, there are teams, the Oakland A's certainly were, you know, the start of it with Moneyball. Magnificent book, by the way. Mm-hmm. Guy's a genius. But the Rays have been a money ball team. Mm-hmm. They've always been a money ball team. And somehow, you know, the only thing we have not done is won a World Series. If we had won a World Series, I think people around the country would look at this team a lot more differently. We have not won a World Series. So they still look somewhat askance. You know, you when you go to MLB and see what the national game of the day is, it's not usually the Rays. It's usually the Los Angeles Dodgers or the Yankees.
Right.
But we have the smartest. This guy, Neander, he should be in the Hall of Fame. The guy's a genius. He's an absolute genius. So this is the brilliance of what Neander does. So we had Tyler Glasnow, and we had Manny, the outfielder. Mm-hmm. And we traded the two of them. I mean, Glasnow was a $25 million pitcher. And Manny was, I don't know, $4 or $5 million himself. We traded him to the Dodgers, and we got two guys back. We got this fella, Papio, mm-hmm. as a pitcher. And he's like $1 million. And this guy right now is as good as anybody. Mm-hmm. He's going on the DL, unfortunately. But what a trade. You know, to trade a $25 million pitcher and get a guy back for $1 million who's just as good.
Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic. And the guy we got back for Manny was Johnny DeLuca, who in four games has driven in 10 runs and has just energized this team mm-hmm. to the point where you think, hey, you know, we could end up in the playoffs. Amazing. That's an amazing trade, among others.
Yeah. Year after year, they do it.
Year after year.
So you mentioned, you know, obviously you're a season ticket holder and a fan. You mentioned the importance of a city in a baseball team. What does it mean to a city to have a baseball team? And what have you seen of cities that have lost baseball teams?
Well, I have friends who they're in their 80s. They were kids when the Brooklyn Dodgers left Brooklyn to go to Los Angeles at the end of the 1956 season. I think so, 56 or 57. And to these people, it's still the worst thing that's ever happened to them in their life.
Mm-hmm.
It took their heart from them. I mean, a baseball team is part of your family. It is. And those people who contend that this city is better off without it. I mean, I was at dinner last night where this fellow across from me was saying that the Rays don't bring any money into St. Petersburg. You know, it was all I could do to reach over the table and choke him to death. But, I mean, this is some of what you're hearing. You know, we should spend our money on other things. I can't think of anything that's more important socially, economically, metaphysically to the city of St. Petersburg than the Tampa Bay Rays. I mean, I would be utterly bereft if this team went somewhere else. And you know they're not going to Tampa because somehow St. Pete gave Tampa 3 years to raise $800 million to move the team over to Tampa. And at the end of the 3 years, they raised $3 million of the $800 million.
And why do you think that is?
You got me. I was surprised. I was shocked, actually, and happy.
So we're in a tricky time now.
I don't think so. I think this is going to go through. The mayor wants it. I know at least half of the council people want it. Not only will you get a new stadium, this big, beautiful stadium, but you'll also be able to transform a large part of what used to be that part of town into something that will be wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the development that's going to spring up around it is a game changer, isn't it?
Absolutely right. I can't imagine. I just can't imagine that they won't pass this.
You've written a lot of books on baseball, and you've interviewed a lot of folks,
mm-hmm.
And become known for your interviewing skills. Asking for a friend, what are some good – how do you be a good interviewer?
I think the most important – elements of being a good interviewer is you have to want to know what you want to know from them. I mean, you have to do the research mm-hmm. to find out what they were involved with. You know, what were the situations? Who were their teammates? We're talking baseball now. Mm-hmm. Who were their teammates? Who were their opponents? Who were their managers? Who were their owners?
Right.
And if you do the research, you find out whatever incidents they were involved with. I mean, in my book now, Baseball Heaven,
mm-hmm.
I have interviewed both Ralph Branca and Bobby Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that because for an awful lot of people, the home run that Thompson hit off of Branca in the 1951 playoffs, it was the shot heard around the world.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly created a tremendous amount of attention for both those men.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did my Dodger book, I interviewed Ralph Branca, And then in 1981, I had my own radio show on WOR in New York. Mm-hmm. And I had the opportunity to interview Bobby Thompson for that show. And so I've taped all the interviews. I've got hundreds and hundreds of taped interviews. Mm-hmm. And for this book, Baseball Heaven, those were certainly two of the people I wanted involved in that book.
So sports figures are known for their cliches and, you know, take it one game at a time and all of that. How do you get to the essence? How do you get beyond that with these players?
You show them you know them. You show them that you know about them. You start with questions that they care about. So I never cared as much about the scores as I did about the people. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, Gary Carter was one of the people I've interviewed.
You became friends with him, right?
Oh, yeah. 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 I spent the 85 season with the New York Mets when I did the book with Davey Johnson, the manager. And it was called Bats, because it's a game that drives you crazy. So you know, after the games, everybody would have dinner, and then Gary and I and Sid Fernandez, we would go out to the movies, while some of the other guys like Keith Hernandez and Doc Gooden and Daryl Strawberry would go and
did other things.
Whatever they were doing. Yeah. Yes. So when I did my book, Amazing, about the Mets, I called Gary and I interviewed him here in Florida, actually on a golf course. He was about to go play golf. And I knew, for instance, that when he was with Montreal, he was a star there as the catcher for the Montreal Expos. But a lot of the ball players didn't like him. Mm. Because he was more than willing to do interviews with the reporters or go on television. The players called him Camera Carter in derision. So you know all this. And so you want to know how he was feeling about, you know, all of that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he came to the Mets, and they won the 1986 World Series. That was after Bill Buckner let the ball roll through his legs. And Carter was part of that experience as well. And so, you know, I had a lot of things to ask him about.
Carter was a contemporary and rival of my favorite player, Carlton Fisk, who was kind of the opposite. He was more of a quiet guy. He didn't do a lot of interviews and things like that. Yeah. How did you find, you think of people that are playing guitar and want to become rock stars. There's a rock star lifestyle that they're keyed into. Mm-hmm. Baseball has its own version of that, the nostalgia and the history and the, you know, to be a legend of the game. And obviously the fans surround themselves with that nostalgia and surround themselves with that, you know, that history.
Mm-hmm, they do.
How did that vary across players as far as how much they were able to really embody that and feel that and exist in that and appreciate that while they were playing, and how many of them were just athletes making a buck?
They're all different. They're just all different.
So Billy Martin, I'll just look at him specifically.
Yeah, Billy Martin. I can't say he was somebody who would go to the railing and sign autographs for fans. That's not what he did. Most of these people did their job.
Yeah.
You know, it was a job. What happened after they retire, they now have something that they didn't have back then, which is to say, they could pay Mickey Mantle $20,000 to come to some place and sign autographs for 3 hours.
Yeah.
You know, and guys, you know, started making very good money signing autographs. Mm-hmm. But back when
Pete Rose at the top of the heap, probably.
Pete Rose is right now. I'm going to see him up in Cooperstown in the middle of July. He's got a place right up there, and he also in Las Vegas. I believe Pete lives in Las Vegas.
But they're heroes. I mean, they're heroes. Doing their job as being a hero, though, even while they're playing. The kids are there screaming for them. And
yeah.
So that's, you know, to me, that's an interesting thing to put on a person and, you know, have to deal with. And you kind of got a behind the scenes look at how they did deal with that. And
it's amazing. I mean, it's just amazing. Can you imagine getting up to bat? The other night, the Mets were leading, 2-1 in the bottom of the ninth. And there were two outs, and a Rosarina was up with two outs. Mm-hmm. And the fans, you know, they're all going crazy because if he makes an out, the game's over. And if he can do something, he can, you know, keep it going for the Rays. And in front of all of those people, He took a 96-mile-an-hour fastball and hit the thing over the left field fence. I mean, I stood there with my hands on my head, just incredulous. I mean, it was very few things that you can go to where you see something that's amazing. And it was. It was amazing. And as he was running around the bases, I was thinking to myself, that's a professional athlete. Who can do that? And then needless to say, in the 10th inning, after the Mets scored a run in the top of the 10th, the Rays then scored two runs in the bottom of the 10th on this Johnny DeLuca, whoever Johnny DeLuca is, our new hero.
Yeah.
Johnny DeLuca hit a triple to drive in two runs to win that game. And you go home just, I mean, where else, literally where else can you go to have such pure joy over something? It was, I got to tell you, it was, again, I'm using the same word, amazing. Mm-hmm. It was.
And that's that's just that thing that, you know, the people who seem to be ambivalent about the Rays leaving just don't get.
I'll tell you something else about the people who talk about that the Rays don't, you know, do anything for the city economically. I very often like to sit with the people, to talk with the people I'm sitting with.
Mm-hmm.
And usually I sit on the third base side, so I'm usually talking with Mets fans or so forth and so on. I must have talked to, a dozen of these Mets fans during these games. And I think one of them lived in St. Petersburg. 11 of them. Three of them came from New York themselves and stayed in a hotel and ate our food and came to our games. And the rest of them came from south of here, Venice. One was from Venice. Another one was from Ocala. I mean, they're coming here and visiting St. Petersburg and spending money.
And what's your take on, you know, how you divide up the stadium costs amongst the benefits? You've seen a lot of stadiums. You've written about stadiums. Where do you come down on that subject?
I come down on the fact that the owner of the team has got something you don't have and something you really want. So if you have the opportunity to get this team in your town, take it. That's my take on it.
Makes a lot of sense. Bouncing back a little bit to the history of the game coming forward, how would you describe how that happens, your role in how that happens? Because if you think about what makes nostalgia, there's an inherent nostalgia. Just, I went there with my family when I was a kid and I have memories of it. But that's like the gasoline, and the spark that really articulates that a lot of time is in work like you do.
Well, I mean, for instance, when I was 12 years old, I went to the Stamford, Connecticut library and I found a book called The New York Yankees by Frank Graham. And in this book, Graham was telling stories about Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Joe DiMaggio. The book came out in 1947. And I was just mesmerized by it. And I was just a kid. So after college and law school, I went to work for Prentice Hall doing law. And after a while, I found a trade book with the books that they did. And I thought to myself, you know, this would be a place where I could do the sequel to The New York Yankees by Frank Graham. And I went downstairs to the trade book division and knocked on the door of the guy in charge and basically talked myself into getting a contract to write my first book, Dynasty. And I could spend an hour talking about the experiences I had visiting all of those Yankees. You know, Mickey Mantle, Whitey Ford, Roger Maris, Elston Howard. Elston Howard, by the way, the entire interview is in this book.
Baseball Heaven.
Yeah.
So you got that yes. You never written a book before.
No.
Talk about that feeling and what the plan you made.
Well, at Dartmouth, I was the sports editor, and my athletic director was Red Rolfe, who had been the third baseman for the Yankees in the 30s and early 40s. And I became close to Red because I loved the fact that he was the third baseman for the Yankees. And I used to write articles about him, and it was just great to be able to sidle up to somebody who had, you know, played ball with DiMaggio and Bill Dickey and so forth and so on. So the other thing is when I was in law school, my friend was the sports editor of the Stanford Advocate. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, if you will give me press credentials, I will write you articles for free. Mm-hmm. And so I got to write articles about the Yankees, the Mets, the New York Knicks, the Jets, the Giants, on the weekends. And I got to do that. So I did articles on O.J. Simpson, articles on Joe Namath. I mean, I had some experience. It's not like I hadn't done anything.
Yeah.
So when I went to this editor at Prentice Hall, I could show him, you know, some of the work that I had done.
And what was, when you were writing those articles, what was your intention other than to inform?
Just to write a great article. That's all.
What makes a great article? I mean, what about your personality are you infusing in there? You know, obviously there's a lot of color available to you in describing
games. Well, that was an opportunity to interview O.J. Simpson.
Yeah.
You know, hey, how many people get to do that?
Yeah.
And so you do your homework, you find out what you want to know, you ask him the questions, and hopefully he tells you.
Yeah. So straight journalism.
It was absolute straight journalism. Yeah. I had nothing more in mind. I was just, you know, writing articles for the Stanford Advocate at the time.
Right. So now you're haunting Yankee Field. You're there and Yankee Stadium, and you're getting to talk to all these folks. Do you remember the sort of early evolution of your confidence level, your willingness to go deep on them, you know, with them and get beyond just, you know, a couple questions about the game? Were you always kind of pushing that envelope?
Yeah, I made my list of questions for whoever I went to see.
Yeah.
And, this is years. This was, you know, years after, they'd stopped playing, most of them.
Yeah.
I mean, Mickey had stopped playing in 68 and I was interviewing him in 73. So this was 5 years later.
Yeah.
That's a funny story. I was supposed to meet him in Dallas where he lives. So I flew to Dallas and I called his house and his wife answered and I said, can I speak to Mickey? And she said, well, Mickey's in New York. Because Mickey was rather, you know, like that. So stayed overnight in the airport, got in a plane, flew to New York and ran, you know, there was Mickey in the Yankee clubhouse the next day. And rarely am I cowed by somebody, but Mickey was somebody who had been my hero all my childhood. So I had interviewed Ellie Howard, and I asked Ellie, I said, Ellie, would you please, please, you know, bring me over to Mickey and introduce me? So we did, and I said, Mr. Mantle, may I ask you some questions, please? And he looks at me, and he goes, no. And then he bursts out into this big cackle. He started cackling and laughing. And we talked for a good hour and 15 minutes, hour and a half. And he told me some incredible things that he had never told anybody else before.
Well, here's what I'm getting at, because you're saying I just wrote a list of questions down, but yet your cold intro to Mickey Mantle within an hour, he's telling you things he's never told anybody before.
Yeah.
That's not just writing a list of questions down. You're building a rapport.
Yeah.
You're knowing what to ask. And this is what I'm trying to dig into and figure out.
I can't tell you why they like me. I can't tell you.
Was it maybe
why.
An earnestness and a, you know, trustworthiness?
Well, that I was serious about what I was doing.
Yeah.
I had done my homework and I cared about them. These were my guys.
And there's that famous story of, I don't know if it's real or not, but it was more of a, to prove a point where, you know, they were on a train and, you know, some reporters were in one of the cars and, you know, Babe Ruth ran through almost naked with a woman chasing him with a knife. And the reporter looked at the other reporter and said, well, I'm glad we didn't see that. Right. So how much of that did you have to do, to keep the, you know, the words?
None of it. There was sort of how I ended up here in St. Petersburg. I was living in Richfield, Connecticut, and I went and I bought the USA Today newspaper, which I rarely did. And there was, in the sports section, was a telephone number. We're starting the Senior Professional Baseball League.
Mm.
And if you're a player and you want to play in the league, call this number. And I thought to myself, wow. You know, I could spend a season with one of these teams,
mm-hmm.
and what a great book this would make. So I called the fellow whose telephone number it was, And he said, come on down to Palm Beach and sit with all the player, the owners, and pick the team you want to spend the season with.
Mm.
Great. So I went down there and I picked the West Palm Beach Tropics.
Oh.
Dick Williams was the manager. Ron Washington was the shortstop. The Mets' great home run hitter, Kingman, was the left fielder. I thought this would be a really interesting team to write a book about. So the next day I got a telephone call. We don't want you. I mean, what do you mean you don't want me? Well, didn't you just write personal fouls about Jim Valvano?
Mm-hmm.
I said, yeah. He said, well, you got Valvano fired. We don't want you. So I called Jim Morley, who was the fellow who started the league, and I told him what the problem was. And he said, not to worry. I'm the owner of the St. Petersburg Pelicans. Mm-hmm. Come and spend the season with the Pelicans. I said, great. Okay. So drive down from Connecticut to St. Petersburg, crossing the Bayway, and the sun is going down. There's the Don Cesar in the background. It's 75 degrees, and I'm thinking, why would anybody want to live anywhere else but here? So the only thing that happened, the next day I went to see Bobby Tolan, the manager, to say hello, and he sits me down and he says, I think we have a problem. I said, what's that, Bobby? He says, well, the players really don't want some strange guy hanging around them. And meanwhile, Doc Ellis, who's in my baseball heaven book, Doc Ellis, who's walking around my chair, and he's going, loser writer, loser writer, loser writer.
Wow.
So I say to Bobby, listen, let me talk to the boys and tell them what I'm doing, to explain to them exactly what it is that I'm doing. He says, fine. So there I am, surrounded by all these former Major Leaguers, big names, good players. And I proceed to tell them that this is a book about players having the opportunity to play the game again, the game they love so much that they had to stop playing, and now you can play it again. And I was talking along those lines, and then I said to them, and if there's something that I'm writing that you don't like, you can read it and take it out.
Hmm.
And then the meeting broke up. Nobody said a word to me. The next day, I got on the bus. We were going to Winter Haven to play the Winter Haven Super Sox.
Hmm.
Nobody said a word. I spent the entire season with the St. Petersburg Pelicans. We won the championship. These people became my close friends. I moved to St. Petersburg shortly thereafter, and it changed my life.
Wow. Twist of fate in there.
Yeah.
A couple twists.
Absolutely.
And a lot of willingness to take risk, you know, because obviously with the Valvano, even though I assume somebody on the other team was a fan or friend of Valvano, still, you know, the fact that
the PR director was the friend of Valvano, the PR director of the West Palm Beach Tropics. And the real irony of it was halfway through the season, he comes over to me and he says, how would you like to change teams and spend the rest of the season with the West Palm Beach Tropics? And the answer was no, of course. You know.
Tell me a little bit about your collection. I know you've got more than one bobblehead. What are some of your favorite bobblehead, and what are some of the other relics you've saved that mean a lot to you?
Well, I don't know what it is about bobbleheads. It sort of keeps these players alive in a funny kind of a way. I have almost all of the Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
I have the 2004 Boston Red Sox carrying their trophies. I have a lot of Pittsburgh Pirates for some reason. I've got a lot of Hall of Famers. And more than anybody else, I have Tampa Bay Rays. Dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of them. Some people collect stamps. I collect bobbleheads.
So what else? Any other things beyond bobbleheads that you've sort of kept?
Well,
you've had friends with players and stuff.
You know, when I wrote the Bronx Zoo, the fellow from Mad Magazine, I had Sport Magazine, you know, put some of it in of the Bronx Zoo in the magazine, and the fellow from Mad Magazine drew a picture of all the Yankees in the dugout, sort of in a jail. I mean, it's just, it's a fabulous keepsake. You know, I bought it from Sport Magazine after it came out. You know, I've got wonderful things. I've got the ticket, the secretariat. Well, I went to the Belmont to see Secretariat win the Triple Crown, and he won, as you know, by 20 lengths. I still have the ticket. I never cashed it in. It was a $2 ticket where you could get $3 back.
Well, no. Worth more than $2 now. I have my guess on this one. I'm gonna sit in my answer until you tell me yours. But if you had to give somebody one Peter Gallenbach book, what would it be?
Oh, that's hard.
I know.
That's very hard. Very, very hard. I suppose it depends who they are.
Baseball.
You know, I think for Yankee fans, I think they would enjoy Dynasty the most. Mm-hmm. The Bronx Zoo was something that they would want to read too, because it's Sparky was hilarious. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really quite amazing how I ended up doing that. After writing Dynasty, I went to work for the Bergen Record, mm-hmm. and I became a journalist and an editor. And I was intending to spend the rest of my life in newspapers when I got a call from Billy Martin's business manager. Billy Martin wants you to do his book with you. Great. So turned out for one reason or another, Billy couldn't do it at that moment, but the guy had one other client, mm-hmm. and that was Sparky Lyle.
Yeah.
So he said, you know, why don't you do a book with Sparky? And I quite naturally said, why would anybody be interested in what Sparky has to say? And very wisely, he said to me, go down to Fort Lauderdale and hang out with Sparky and you'll see. And I did that.
Yeah.
And you're standing in the clubhouse. And who are you standing with? You're standing with Reggie Jackson. You're standing with Thurman Munson. You're standing with Catfish Hunter. You're standing with Billy Martin. George Steinbrenner's hovering above. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me, you know, if Sparky would keep a diary of the season, this could really be interesting. And a number of things turned out. Well, the Steinbrenner had bought Goose Gossage during the winter for $2 million. Mm-hmm. Sparky was making $140,000. So Sparky knew that he was losing his closer job.
Mm-hmm.
So not only was Sparky a great reporter, but he was also, you know, spitting mad.
Mm.
You know, so he had no problem telling me what in the world was going on with the Yankees during the entire 1978 season. And, you know, when that book hit the stands, you know, it was like a bomb went off in New York. It was really very exciting. Very, very exciting. You know, and it also, you know, obviously changed my life. So I didn't become a newspaper reporter. I wrote that book, which became a New York Times bestseller. And then I wrote Billy's book, which was called Number One. And that became a New York Times bestseller. Mm-hmm. And I had a career.
It's fantastic. And it's funny, and so my guess, just so, because I know people don't like an unclosed loop. When I said I'm going to sit on my answer, my guess was going to be bums, mainly because of the positioning of an understanding with Jackie Robinson. And I thought, you know, that was a moving thing for you that you were
bums. Able to, bums. Yeah. Bums was special to me. When I was 10 years old, my uncle Justin Gollenbach took me to the 1956 World Series. That was the New York Yankees against the Brooklyn Dodgers. Mm. And he took me there, well, to see the game, but also he was Jackie Robinson's attorney. And Jackie was moving from wherever he was in New York to Stamford, Connecticut.
Mm.
And so after the game, Uncle Justin and I went down to meet this man. And I'm 10, and he's Jackie Robinson. And he looked like, you know, a giant.
Mm.
I never forgot it. And so my senior paper at Dartmouth was about Jackie Robinson and his effect on, you know, American culture. And when I had the opportunity to write Bums, I think the most important person who I interviewed in that book, and believe me, I interviewed everybody, was Rachel Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
And she remembered me. You know, she loved my uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And so she gave me a fantastic, fantastic interview. And that's the thing really that made Bums even more special than it was.
And you've often said that had that gone a different way, you know, Jackie's acceptance or, you know, there's some rumors, it could really change things in America at large.
Without a doubt. I mean, I even when I was writing it in 1980, I'm not sure people quite understood how important Jackie was to the civil rights movement. I think if Jackie had failed, you might not have had Brown versus Board of Education. You might not have had a lot of things. It might have taken a lot longer. But once he succeeded, and one of the books I wrote was called In the Country of Brooklyn. Mm. And I interviewed a bunch of people who were Brooklyn Dodger fans, and they talked about Jackie. And you know, they were white. Jackie was African-American. They wanted to be him, you know. And a lot of them ended up being lawyers, which is kind of fun. One of them ended up being the head of the ACLU. All these people who saw what Jackie did and just were overwhelmed by what it meant.
So I wanted to come back to Bums just to close that loop, but you were talking about having a career as a writer, and I found it quite interesting, the inbound that you've gotten. You know, you said, I think I saw where you said that there's a lot of folks you'd love to write biographies about or co-write autobiographies with that they're just hard to get a hold of, but you've had a steady stream of inbound interest. But it's really come from all over the place.
Sure,
you know, from trial lawyers to, you know, obviously some race car stuff. And so, how do you find joy in all those different subjects? Just grand wide curiosity, and how do you decide which projects to take and which don't?
It's just mostly the love of the work.
Yeah,
love doing it.
But is a devotion? I mean, how long? You know, you did the Casey Anthony book. How long did you have to spend on that?
A year.
That's a year of your life.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. And Jose Baez was incredible. What he did, what the lengths that he went to save her from going to prison were unbelievable.
Hmm.
I mean, that prosecutor, he made up stuff. He lied. He wanted her to go to prison.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth of the matter is that Casey Anthony was asleep when her daughter drowned.
Mm-hmm.
And her father... And the thing you discover is her father had been having sex with Casey Anthony since he was 8 years old.
Hmm.
8 years old. And so on this particular day, when the kid was born, the question was, you know, was her father the father of this child? And he wasn't, fortunately. But when the child died, the father was supposed to be watching her, and she walked up the stairs to their pool and fell in the pool, couldn't get out, and drowned. And so what did the father do? The father went, in the past, when their animals had died, the father had taken the dog's bodies, put them in a black paper bag, and threw them in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
He did the same thing with the body of this girl. And he was a former policeman, so nobody, you know, looked at him.
Mm-hmm.
The prosecutor never looked at him.
Mm-hmm.
They all looked at Casey Anthony, and they were all convinced that somehow she had killed her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And there was stuff in the trunk, and it was supposed to be the dead body that was in the trunk, and it had flies and so forth and so on. And the prosecutor came up with all of this nonsense. And Jose Baez, step by step by step by step, proved that none of that they were talking about was true. None of it. And the jury was out about 10 minutes. I know they found her not guilty so fast it wasn't funny. And even to this day, people don't believe that she was innocent, oddly enough.
Yeah, it's a tough thing in this world. You get out in the media as guilty, you're guilty.
Yep.
So, and I'm curious, just have you been 6 months into a year project and said, what am I doing here?
No.
So you've been pretty good about your due diligence before committing to that.
Yeah. Well, not all of them work out.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes the person you're working with turns out to be not somebody you should be working with.
Mm.
It's happened.
And as far as the business itself goes, you know, you said, you know, obviously a lot of people say that the internet changed things. You've said that it was actually the death of the local bookstore.
Absolutely.
That impacted your sales the most.
Absolutely. Though I must say, here in St. Petersburg with Tombolo Books,
yeah,
those people are doing a fabulous, fabulous job making books available, doing publicity, having, you know, the authors come and do little shows. They've been great. They just have been great. I admire them tremendously. They're doing a great, great job.
And we actually own St. Pete Press. And so we do about we do about a dozen books a year by local authors.
Wow.
Actually put on an annual event every year, which I'll make sure you get an invite to. We have it at the Palladium.
I'd love to come.
It's just a night of we bring in a representative from a bookseller, someone in education, a writer, and a publisher, and just kind of give a state of the industry in St. Pete.
Yeah.
And we have fun. You know, Paul Wilborn plays a few tunes. Roy Peter Clark. We give away actually the Roy Peter Clark Award every year.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah. And so
that's just true. The hardest thing in the world is doing publicity for your book.
Yes.
It's very, 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 very hard.
And there's no short answer on how to do that.
You go on MSNBC and every single one of those people have a book out.
Yep.
And you say to yourself, how in the world can I compete with, you know, people who are on nationwide television,
yeah,
you know, promoting their books? It's just very, very hard.
Yeah. But you never considered jumping into anything else? I guess you did some broadcasting. Some broadcasting.
You know, I did that at WOR.
Yeah.
I did that for 9 months. I was making a solid $100 a week. But I had a ball. I had, you know, wonderful figures come on, baseball players, tennis players, hockey players. You know, after the 9 months, I was, you know, financially it was becoming difficult. Yeah. So I said to them, you know, could you make it $300 a week? And they said no. So that was the end of my radio career.
Well, I appreciate you stopping by and sharing some stories. And I was very interested to hear your thoughts on the Rays, and it's pretty clear that
well, we have something here that's very, very, very special.
Yeah.
You know, and the thought that anybody could say, let him go.
Mm.
I don't know. I just don't understand it. It literally makes me crazy.
That's a good place to end. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir.